Thank you, everyone, for coming this evening to learn. It's always nice to learn. I just want a very brief introduction. So I met Rabbi Kelman in Mount Sinai Hospital in 1960.
That's not fair.
The incubators.
So we were born a week apart, and
you stayed in those days, and mother stayed in the hospital.
They stayed in the hospital
until the bris. Until the bris.
How I know him really is because I was at shul with his beloved father, Rabbi Joseph Kelman, and Rabbi Joseph Kelman. First of all, Jay and I were friends. I'm going to call him Jay just for a second.
Of course,
for the rest of the evening, he's Rabbi Kelman.
No, Jay.
But we grew up as friends in elementary school together, and then you know how people are, they drift apart. You do your own thing, and everybody goes off. And Rabbi Kelman stayed on the derech, and I was completely off the derech, doing my own thing. But his father actually brought me back to my roots by mentoring me and helping me along my way, becoming a chazan. He helped plant me into the city and helped me with achieving the position that I have today at Beth David for the last almost 20 years. And so I'm very grateful. But your mother was also very instrumental and very helpful as well with wonderful advice. But what going forward, about 2 years ago, I was walking back. We passed each other. So Rabbi Kelman would go to Or Chaim, and I was going to Beth David and our Crossroad path. And I said, 20-something years ago, your father said, I should learn with you because you have a lot to teach. And I would always say, sure, I will someday. But 20 years went by, and I didn't do anything about it. So 2 years ago, I said, can you find somebody for me so I can learn? I want to learn Gemara. I need to start learning. And he said, give me a little while, think about it. And each week I passed by, but I didn't say anything. I didn't say, did you find new or anything like that? I just waited. And about, I don't know, a month or a little longer after that, he stopped me and he said, I found somebody for you. And I said, who did you find? He said, me. And I started in my second year learning, and I'm thrilled. He always pays me a great compliment because he says, I'm learning with Chazan Lumer. But the truth is he's not learning with, I'm learning from him. And I saw how much there was to learn and how great a teacher you are at CHAT, but in the whole community. So I wanted to share that with other people from the community. So here we are now. We're gathering to learn a little bit about Megillat Esther, Rabbi Jay Kelman.
Thank you very much. Wow. I appreciate the introduction. He said it just as I wrote it. Okay. I don't really know anybody. And instead of spending time, I know a few people. But most of them I don't. I'll get to know you in the social hour. Feel free to interrupt. You want to say your name. If you have any questions, that might help. Okay. So we figured this is going to be a five-part series on Megillat Esther. I don't know the backgrounds of people, and so if I say something you're not clear, please ask me, please interrupt me, and okay, so we'll start. Esther's a beautiful book, everybody loves it, everybody loves Purim, it's like our favorite holiday, the most fun holiday, it's the most un-Jewish holiday, of course, there is. We do everything that you're not supposed to do all year, like we party and we get drunk and we costumes and, you know, all kinds of things that make noise in shul and like all, well, that they do all year, but all the things you're not supposed to do all year. So we do on Purim, but the truth matter, and often in the excitement, people don't pay attention to Megillat Esther, which is really a unbelievable book. A book that took a long time to be accepted in the biblical canon. In the Talmud, there's a whole debate between Esther and the sages where Esther said, I have a great book. And the sage says, no big deal. Well, who needs another book? Well, what happened to Megillat Esther? We don't need it. And it was a long, drawn-out process until Purim finally became accepted. And not only that, it's really the only, pretty much, I think, outside of Kriyat Shema, it's like the only mitzvah we do at night and in the morning. Like, we have a Pesach Seder at night. We light Hanukkah candles at night. We lay Eicha on Tish B'Av at night. We take a lulav in the day. We blow shofar in the day. We don't do something in the day and at night. It's very, very unusual. And that's really only a custom. A lot of people maybe are surprised to find out that the main reading in the Megillah is really in the day. I know the shuls are more crowded at night than they are in the morning, but the real time to read the Megillah is in the daytime. The night was added on later because of the Megillah. But anyways, it's really the only book for sure we read twice, and if you go to Israel, you can do it actually four times, which of course I did a couple of times, because you go to Yerushalayim, you go to wherever, to Gush Etzion or Tel Aviv on the 14th of Adar, and then you go to Jerusalem on the 15th of Adar, because that's something we'll have to, maybe we'll get to later on, why Purim of all holidays is split like that, that we celebrate in walled cities on one day and not in walled cities in another day. Especially Purim is supposed to be the holiday of Jewish unity, Mishloach Manot, Matanot Levyanim, and it's really the holiday that is the most disunited holiday, because in Jerusalem it's one day, everywhere else it's another day. Okay, we'll have to get to that. Okay, so I'll start with a question, please. I don't like to lecture those who've been to my classes. I like to, you know, have a discussion. So we'll discuss why, what's the problem in Megillat Esther, why the sages did not want to accept Megillat Esther and Purim, let's say, into our canon of holidays. Throw it out. What's strange on Megillat Esther? God's name isn't mentioned. Okay, great. That's a famous one. Why isn't God's name mentioned? Okay, we'll come to that. Good. What else?
Esther married a non-Jew.
Esther married a non-Jew. Good. Okay. All right. Very good. Yeah. How Jewish was Esther?
Well, Mordechai was.
Esther was pretty assimilated. Yeah. I said like modern Jews. You know, Esther's very, it's very interesting. What's Esther's other name?
Hadassah.
It's only mentioned once in the Megillah. By the way, Hadassah's name is only mentioned once. And then she's always Esther. Now, Esther, of course, is a Persian name, but the rabbis have a habit of doing things like this. The rabbis made Esther, we all know that Esther's, of course, now a nice Jewish name, but the rabbis made Esther into a Jewish name, meaning what? Hidden. Lahastir. Who's hidden? God. God's name is hidden. And they actually quote the Pasuk, Anochi astir panai, God will hide his face, which actually is sort of part of the curses that God is telling the Jewish people, if we sin in the future, I'm going to turn my face away from you. It's actually not a pleasant verse. So Esther, which is not really a Jewish name, becomes a Jewish name. I mean, we have that on Moshe Rabbeinu. I mean, you know, Moshe isn't a Jewish name either. He was named by an Egyptian, you know, princess who pulled him out of the water. Keep in mind, Moshe too. So the rabbi somehow converted some Egyptian name into a Hebrew name. That's a very common theme they do. Okay, there's no mention of God in the Megillah. The hero is an assimilated Jew. Mordechai, of course, is also a Persian god, Marduk. It's also not a, it didn't used to be a Jewish name. That was a nice Jewish name, yes.
The whole story is set in Galut.
The whole story is set in Galut, and therefore, you are correct.
Well, that sets it apart from
that's one of the reasons that Talmud says we don't say hello on Purim. You know, on all the holidays we say hello. Well, almost. We don't say no Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur either. That's because we're too nervous. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is not the day to be dancing up. Hello, you have to sing and dance and, you know, the choir and the chazan. Where's the chazan? You know, you have to sing and, you know, beautiful songs. So that's Rosh Hashanah, we're a little bit too nervous. But we say it on Hanukkah, we say it on Pesach, we say it all the other holidays. We don't say it on Purim. So one of the reasons the Gemara gives is because it happened outside of Israel. But we have to find out why. Like, why is that important?
Well, when you look at Yeshayahu, you look at the prophets of the Galut from Babylonia, they were also outside. They weren't in Israel either.
Right. Well, okay, so prophecy can only happen in the land of Israel. That's what our say. Yechezkel prophesied outside of Israel because he was, but he started from Israel. And Yonah wanted to run away.
Yeah, right.
When we read on Yom Kippur, because if I get out of Israel, I can't give any prophecy. That's also because only in Israel, what's a prophet? I mean, that's a whole other discussion. But basically, it's someone who can attain the highest level of closeness unto God. You look at the Rambam, there's nothing, I mean, maybe it's not miraculous like out of the normal. It's just a person who's attained a very, very high level of spirituality. And that can only be attained in the land of Israel. Because as we're reading now, Israel, the Parsha now, all the boring Parsha now in the Torah, Truma, Tetzaveh, all the boring stuff. So it is. It's more boring. I prefer the stories of Yaakov and Yosef are more interesting stories. Well, what can I tell you? But what are the parshiot about? They're parshiot that God's home is in the Mishkan. God dwells in the Mishkan. The Mishkan, that's why Yerushalayim is the holiest city, because that's where God's resting place is. whatever that means exactly. But we'll come back to that, because Achashverosh is like palace, is also like the Mishkan. We'll come back to some of these things. Okay, good. What else? What else is wrong in the Megillah? It happens outside of Israel. No mention of God, no mention of the temple, no mention of Israel, no mention of Zecher Liyetziat Mitzrayim, no mention of the Avod. I'm just adding a few things we haven't said. What else? How does the Megillah end?
Yeah. The Jews are allowed to go and kill all their adversaries.
That's it. Okay. Already get into that. Okay. And therefore?
Well, it seems like...
Not a good reason to celebrate. If you have to kill people.
Yeah.
War is not a good thing to celebrate. That's what some people say on Hanukkah. That's why we have the miracle of the oil, whatever. We don't want to celebrate the victory of the Chashmonaim, maybe. So that's, right. So we have to, what are we celebrating on Purim? Good. How did that, we'll come to that. I wasn't planning to now, but okay, we'll get there. What are we celebrating on Purim? I don't think we're celebrating a military victory. I don't think so.
Victory over our enemies.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, fine. We'll come back to. So what happened? What's the end of the story? So
the problem is that we stay in Shabbat into.
Right. So what's the end of the story of Egypt? What's the end of the story of Egypt?
It's Yom
Mitzrayim. What's the end of the story? Actually, we're,
the Ten Commandments.
Where does the story of the Exodus end?
Is this
so there's been, of course, a machloket. Everything's a machloket.
Yom Suf.
Where does the story of what was the goal of the Exodus?
Either Sinai or the Mishkan.
Ah, excellent. So which do you think it is?
It depends whether you're the right.
Yeah, you understand what I'm asking? In other words, we all know it's very physical freedom is nice. It's important in and of itself, but that's not the end game. Like, how do I know it's not the end game? Let's say I don't know anything. I don't know anything. And I open up a Chumash. So how do I know from looking at the Chumash that Exodus isn't the end game? Even though everything we do is for Egypt. We have no mention, no memories of Har Sinai in our liturgy. There's nothing. We never mention Zecher Lahar Sinai. Have you ever heard that expression? Zecher Liyetziat Mitzrayim, you say Kiddush Friday night, the mezuzah, the Shema, Tefillin. Everything we do is to remember the Exodus. There's nothing we do to remember Mount Sinai. There's nothing we do for that. Including, now, I don't really go there, but including the holiday of Shavuot is not really for the remembrance. Sorry, I don't want to shake anybody up here, but most likely that's a later historical development. If you look in the Torah, Torah makes no mention of Shavuot as the day we receive the Torah. It's not mentioned anywhere in the Torah. In the Torah, Shavuot is an agricultural holiday, and that's why it's only one day. Pesach at the beginning, Sukkot at the end, you know, we can take off, the farmer can take a week off, but in the middle of the summer, can't take off a week. So the holiday of Shavuot, it's described in the Torah. It's the grains, it's the beginning of the wheat harvest, and we have to bring Bikurim, beginning of the Bikurim season, the first, nothing to do with receiving of the Torah. That probably came later, because when we're exiled from the land, it's very strange to celebrate a agricultural holiday of a land you don't live in. Like, doesn't really make too much sense. So, the rabbi, why don't we memorize? So, why don't we have anything to remember Har Sinai? Why is everything to remember the Exodus? Why don't we have anything to remember Har Sinai?
It's the end of the golden calendar.
Homework for next week. Okay.
Make that, we could imbue that little mountain in Sinai with a specific type of holiness that it doesn't really deserve. We could be fixated on just that.
So the Temple Mount today, as you know, His Holiness, and I'm not talking like in the political sense, Temple Mount, there is a debate between the Rambam and the Raiva. It's not important right now, but most people know Jews, although it's changing a little bit, generally assume observant Jews don't walk on the Temple Mount. The Arabs are happy about that, but we don't walk on the Temple Mount because it's got holiness, and we are in a state of impurity. If anybody went to a funeral, was in a room with the dead bodies in a state of impurity, and we don't have the process to totally purify ourselves, so we can't go on the Temple Mount. That's the generally accepted view. Temple Mount is still holy. There hasn't been a temple there in 2,000 years. Mount Sinai, we didn't even know where it is. There's no holiness to Mount Sinai. That's very interesting. So why is that? So without getting into it, okay, should I answer it or give? I should answer it. Okay, fine. Okay, I don't know. One possible approach is because the Torah didn't want to have a holiday to celebrate the receiving of the Torah. Yeah, we receive the Torah every day. By learning Torah, by having a mezuzah in our house, by Shabbat, that's what we. There's no holiday for Torah. We observe Torah 365 days a year. We need 1 week a year to eat matzah. We need a week a year to remind ourselves of freedom and slavery and make sure we don't enslave others. So we have to remind ourselves what it's like to be a slave. We need reminders. We need a reminder once a year, 10 days, to focus on repentance, how we can do better. We need once a year to leave our houses, to know that our house is not our permanent place. You know, we think we protect ourselves. We've got to go out to the elements. But we don't do that all year. We have different times of the year. But Torah is all year. Torah is 365 days a year. So there's not a day to celebrate the receiving of the Torah. But anyways, back to our original question. So where does the Exodus end? So most people would say with the giving of the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. So the story of the Exodus, the goal of the Exodus ends in the white count 49 days, figure of Omer. We tied that in somehow. It's also a later interpretation. But anyway, but why is that most likely not completely correct?
We still have to wander in the desert to get there to Israel.
Correct. But how does Sefer Shemot end? How does the book of Shemot end? The boring parsha we're reading now. The building of the tabernacle. So the Ramban, Nachmanides, the second most important commentary of the Bible after Rashi, 1194, 1271, Spain, then he moved to Israel the last few years of his life. The Ramban, Nachmanides, explains in his introduction to Shemot, that's what, there's a three-step process. Physical freedom, Exodus, spiritual freedom, Torah, and building a sanctuary, which he explains is the continuation of Sinai. That we should have Sinai with us all the time. The Mishkan is the culmination. That's why the book of Shemot ends with the building of the tabernacle. Vayikra is what you use the tabernacle for, and the book should have ended there. The Torah should be only three books, but what can we do? The Jewish people sinned. They didn't want to go to the land of Israel. So the spies, and that set us back. So we need another 15 weeks. The Korach and the spies and Bilam and Balak. Interesting again, but... Anyways, that's sort of the structure of the Torah, that the Torah really should have ended. But, okay, so that's the end of the Exodus. What's the end of the Megillah? Let's get back here to the Megillah. That's what we're supposed to talk about. What's open up. You can cheat. Everybody can cheat. How does the Megillah end? It's a letdown, actually. You look in the Megillah, it's actually...
It says that Mordecai was...
The second last verse, I guess. We'll get to the last verse in a second, because that's also fascinating. Let's start chapter 10, page 31 in this book. Vayasem emelach Achashverosh mas ala aretz v'yeyayam. Achashverosh taxed the people. That's what it says. V'chol ma'asei tokvo gvorotov v'roshak v'la Mordecai, asher gidlo ha'melach kaloim tuvim osever divrei yamim. And all the exploits of the king, you can read about it in the history books. Mordechai Yehudi, Mordechai the Jew, it's only, I think, the second time. When we first introduced Mordechai, Ish Yehudi Ayabu Shushan, Shmo Mordechai, and then it's Mordechai Yehudi Asher, and then here, otherwise he's just Mordechai. But Mordechai the Jew, the second in command to King Achashverosh, he was big among the Yehudi and the Jews. Ratzui, he was beloved by the majority of his brothers. He sought out peace for everybody. So how does the Megillah end? The rabbis say, you know why else we don't say hallel? Forget Israel. You know why we don't say hallel? Because nothing happened. There's no story here. No story taxes. And you know what? You couldn't vote Achashverosh out. Couldn't vote for a guy who's going to cut taxes. That's it. You're stuck. That's how the Megillah ends. So the rabbis say, no halam purim, akate update Achashverosh. We're still slaves to Achashverosh. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. There's nothing here to celebrate. What happened is the Jews were almost killed and they weren't. In other words, great. I mean, but nothing really happened. We were living in peace in Shushan to figure out when the Megillah happened. And then this guy Haman came along and he thought he was going to wipe us out. And it didn't happen. Great. And then what happened? Nothing. We didn't go back to Israel. We didn't build a temple. We didn't do anything. We just paid taxes. We paid taxes. So what's to celebrate? So we have to figure out what there is to celebrate. What are we celebrating? Yes.
I have a question. I hate to be provocative.
Oh, for sure. I don't.
But in the Septuagint, there are five other chapters of Esther.
Okay.
Verse 4 talks about the dreams of Mordechai. And the first sentence, chapter 10, verse 4, says, and Mordechai, in the name of God, said these things.
Okay.
And the rest of the chapter has the name of God about 10 times.
So I'm not familiar, to be honest. I don't know. I can't comment on that. I just don't know. Uh-huh. So, but the Megillah that we have in our possession has no name of God. Now, okay, let's discuss for a minute, not the Septuagint, but when did this story take place? Anybody know?
Nobody knows.
Yeah. Why does nobody know?
Because there's no correlation.
The question is, of course, why? See, I'm just throwing that we have to discuss.
Number. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any historical sense.
No.
It says that he came out with Yechaniah at the time of the exile, and yet she was a young. And by the time this particular king was around, it was like 100 years later. She wouldn't have been a young woman at all.
Yeah, the historic doesn't make sense.
Right. Okay, I'm not going to get into the whole scholarship about history. There is a big problem in the Persian period in history because. The Persian period lasted a couple hundred years, and according to the sages of the Talmud, the Persian period was only 52 years, which that's beyond what we have to discuss now.
Maybe
but,
it never happened.
Ah, okay, it could be. In the introduction, this wonderful book by David Silber, who was the founder of Drisha, if anybody heard of it, in Manhattan, now they're in Israel. He was really one of the pioneers of women's learning in the 70s, founded an institute for higher learning for women, Talmud, everything. So he has in his introduction, he's sort of doing a literary analysis of the book. And he writes the history doesn't interest him at all. He doesn't even know if the story happened. He couldn't care less if the story happened. I don't know that I'm not sure I agree with him 100%. And in certain circles, that would be considered sort of heretical. But his point is, and as we're going to discuss, the Megillah is not about a historical event. Because what's the Megillah about? Now let's get back to why God's name is missing. What's the Megillah about? The Megillah is about how a Jew lives when God is not manifest in the world. So when does the Megillah take place? Well, when is God not manifest in the world? Now.
Right now.
Last year, 10 years ago, 50 years, 102 years, ever since the end of prophecy. Right? The rabbis say that Esther is the last of the prophets. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, see, we don't think like this. What is a prophet? We've never met a prophet, right? The Talmud says there are only two types of prophets now. Anybody know who the two types of prophets we have in our time? The rabbis say are children and fools. Children and fools. Those are the only two prophets. It's a beautiful teaching of our sages. A child is naive and innocent and sees a beautiful future. Isn't all corrupted by the world yet. And anybody thinks their prophet is an idiot. By the way, the role of the prophets, it's a big misconception, just for 1 minute, is not to predict the future. That's not the role of the prophet. The prophet is a social critic. That's clear from, read what the prophets say. They're social critics. They warn us that if we don't get our house in order, the enemies will take over. You don't need to be a prophet. You don't need any special powers to know that if a society crumbles from inside, it collapses. All of history is like that. So they weren't predicting the future. They got a vision from God, and yes, God may have told them some ideas about the future, and they may have warned us. Yirmiyahu warns us, if you know, no better, the temple will be destroyed, etc., etc. But the period of prophecy comes to an end. God's name is not mentioned. Is that good or bad? Well, you have a 50-50 chance. Yeah. I don't know. I like to say it's good.
It's good for those who are learning to be scribes.
No, that's because there's no God's name. When you write a Megillah, you can correct a mistake. So I think, why do we have a, it's sort of like raising children and they leave the home. Is that good or bad? When the kids leave the house. Right, it's a little bit of both. In other words, we need a prophecy. What does a prophet do? A prophet tells us, do X and it'll be good. In other words, prophets are social critics, but their social criticism is sort of a guarantee from God. If you give to the poor and you treat the orphan properly, you know, and don't just have a fast day. I don't care about your fast days. I only care if you give bread to the poor. Right, the fast days is a way to know what it's like to be hungry, so you'll help other people. So then things will go well. But we left Egypt. We had a slave mentality. We didn't know anything. We didn't know what we're doing. So God sent us prophets, Moshe, Yeshua. Just listen to the leaders and Shmuel, Yeshua. They'll tell you what to do. At a certain point, the kid has to grow up. After 1,500 years, the Jewish people have to grow up. And God's not going to tell you what to do. And the rabbis say, a chacham atif minavi, a sage is greater than a prophet. Prophets are not allowed to rule on Jewish land. Prophets, we don't prophets. We want sages. We want people who study. Every page of the Talmud, arguments, debates. We don't know. We don't know what's right. Okay, that's fine. We live with uncertainty. Yes, sir. No one's introducing themselves, by the way, one day. Okay.
Norm Silver.
How do you do?
I have two questions. One, does it make a difference if the story was true?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it makes a difference. I'll tell you, I forget his name now. I keep forgetting his name. You may remember it. Rabbi in L.A., one of the most well-known rabbis.
David Wolpe
gave a speech 15 years ago, made the front page of the New York Times. That's pretty impressive. A rabbi gave a speech in shul on Shabbos, and it makes it to the front page of the New York Times. So what did he say? He said that he doesn't know if the Exodus happened. He doesn't know. He doesn't know historically if it happened. He said he doesn't care. It's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. Because the message, now, I'm of two minds. Sometimes I say, I agree. Who cares if the Exodus? The Torah is not a history book. That's for sure true. Torah is a book of current events. The rabbis say there were thousands of prophets. We only know of 55 prophets. 48 men and 7 women. Esther is the last one, right? 48 men and 7 women. Why don't we know about the other 3,000? Because their prophecy was irrelevant for 2019. Because anything written in the Torah is for us. It's not for historical purposes. There may be history in the Torah, but Torah is not at all a history book. That doesn't mean it's not historically true. It just means it's not a history book. Now, by the way, the sages say we had 55 prophets. How effective were they?
Not so effective.
You know who was effective? That guy took the ring off and he sealed the documents and he sent it to 127 provinces. You heard of him? Achashverosh. Haman, he was the most successful prophet. Why? Because the Jews woke up and they repented. We'll get to that. He was more successful when the Jews thought they were going to be wiped out. He was more successful than all prophets. So if it's true, so part of me says, I don't care if the Exodus is true. It's, or the Torah, I mean, I don't know if I would go, I don't think I would say that, but let's say I don't care if the Megillah is true because the Megillah is not meant as a thing. The rabbis always say the book of Job may have never happened. The book of Job, according to many rabbis in Talmud, there was no person Eov. He didn't exist. It was a philosophical work to deal with pain and suffering and struggle, etc. But it didn't really happen. How far can you extend that? It's not generally accepted to say that the Exodus didn't happen. That's not normally an accepted view. But I don't know how much difference it makes. Part of me says, if you don't think the Exodus happened, eat bread on Pesach. I mean, we don't celebrate Pesach like a fairy tale. We believe it happened. But I don't think it's that important if the Megillah happened. And I think the Megillah is written in a way with no historical context for that reason.
Well,
I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm just saying, I don't know how important it is.
There are people today that are trying to undermine our roots by saying that the Exodus didn't happen.
Right, so I'm just saying.
I would say that the Megillah did happen.
Okay.
And the proof of that is that in the town of Hamadan, which is northwest of Tehran, there's the tomb of Esther and Mordecai.
Right. Right. There's no reason to believe it didn't happen. I don't want, like, hey, you're going for, I don't know people. You're going to walk out. The rabbi said, you know, the Exodus maybe, like, I don't want anybody to say that. But I'm saying the goal, even of the Exodus, which I do believe happened, the goal, let's make that clear. The goal of the, and I believe the Purim story also happened. I also believe it happened. But that's not the goal of the story. The goal, in other words,
of course.
The assumption is it happened. Because if it didn't happen, what's the whole point of it? But
it was accepted by the people around there.
Yeah, but the fact that there's somebody grave there, I don't know, that's not proof enough. That's
Farsi, right. So that shows that it was accepted.
It shows other cultures had a similar story, right? It doesn't necessarily, I mean, again, this is, you know, but the Megillah more than other books is devoid of historical context. So we don't have a clue. And the rabbis debate. The rabbis, of course, assumed it happened. Let's assume it happened. I assume it happened. Debate, when did it happen? So the generally accepted, the rabbinic view tends to be it happened between the two temples. that Cyrus the Great in 537 allowed the Jews back to Israel. Temple's destroyed in 586 BCE. And this happens, and what do most Jews do? They don't go back to Israel. And that's getting back to what you said at the beginning. Purim happened outside of Israel, and maybe there is tension. That's already some commentaries right today, and that's why the people, there was such a great difficulty accepting Purim. People in Israel were mad. Why did you stay in Persia? Come back to Israel. How many Jews went back to Israel in 537 or 1948, the same thing, but whatever. How many Jews went back? 42,000. The book of Ezra tells us 42,000 out of millions.
A lot of them stayed.
Most of them stayed. And you know what they did? They intermarried. That's why I say it's current events. Everything in the Bible is current events. The Jews, they didn't speak English. They didn't speak Hebrew properly. So the rabbis invented the Shmon Esrei, how to daven. Prayer is not supposed to have a fixed text. How can you have a fixed text for something that comes from the heart? Prayer in the Torah is worship of the heart. You can't tell a heart to have a fixed text. The rabbis didn't want a fixed text or prayer. That's a terrible thing. But they didn't know any Hebrew. They want to tell somebody to pray today. I don't know. What am I supposed to say? So the rabbis gave us a fixed text. 18 blessings. 19 blessings. And they said, you know what? Most people don't know Hebrew. So the cantor is going to repeat the 19 blessings. So, and you'll stand there and answer amen. That's why people didn't know how to read Hebrew. And for those who did, we kept the Shmon Esrei silent so you could add your own prayers, because we don't want you bound by a fixed text. It's so different than our conception of prayer today. But that's what happened. The Jews became assimilated. They didn't know Hebrew. They intermarried. It says in the Mishnah, Ezra brought back a bunch of people. He brought back the Stukis, a Sufi, Kuti. You don't have to know what these are, but let's say the lower class. I don't mean like economically. I mean the people who their Jewish status was questionable. We don't know. Mamzerim, illegitimate children. It was not a good scene. And the Jews were very ignorant coming back to Israel. So, you know, why did they stay in Persia? So the rabbis say they were having a good time at Ahasuerus's party. That's what there's a view in the Talmud. You know why this thought haven't happened? Ahasuerus makes a party 180 days and the Jews go to celebrate. What are the Jews going to? What are they eating at this party? What are they drinking? You know, what are they doing there? So this was a punishment. Now that's not I don't know if that's the way the rabbis are reading it. Whether it's true or not doesn't matter. And that aspect, that's not in the Megillah itself, that the rabbis are reading into it. So the book of Esther may have happened during that time period, the 7 years of exile, or some say it happened later, 100, which is in a sense even worse. In other words, it happened 50, 75 years after the temple is already rebuilt. I understand the first 7 years, he wants to go, it's hard in Israel. And then people live in the desert, nobody. But when Israel becomes a high-tech country, I'm sorry. And Israel, you know, it becomes like this, you know. So then they didn't go back. Even after the temple, the Jews are staying in Persia, 127 places. So there's a lot going on in the Megillah. And that might explain why Purim is the 15th in Jerusalem and the 14th everywhere else. Now, by the way, why is it in the 15th in Jerusalem? Why is Purim on the 4th and 15th? What do you need to celebrate on the 15th? You have to be a walled city from?
Time
of Joshua. Yeah, you learned too much. That's not fair. You cheated.
Well, I thought you said something else.
No, there was...
It could have been because of Shushan itself.
Right. It says in the Megillah, the Jews in walled cities had an extra day. In Shushan, they had an extra day. So it says, okay, anybody in a walled city celebrates on the 15th. So they say, anybody lived in a walled city from the time that was walled from the time of Joshua? That doesn't make any sense. Be walled from the time of Ahasuerus. It's walled from the time of Mordechai. Who cares what was walled in the time of Joshua? So the rabbis say to give honor to the land of Israel. The land of Israel was destroyed and desolate and nobody was there. So we're going to celebrate Purim in Shushan. My cousin in 1971, we were on sabbatical, and I was a 9-year-old kid in 1970. Our family was in sabbatical. I went to grade 4 in Israel, and my third cousin, who has lived in Israel ever since, he still lives in Israel, was studying at JTS, actually, the Conservative Rabbinic Seminary. He was in Israel. He became a lawyer. Now he's back in rabbinate. So he flew, this is 1970, he flew to Persia for Purim. Persia. He flew to Iran. For Purim, the Shah of Iran, there was a time we had good relations with Iran. He flew to Iran for Purim. So yeah, Purim in Iran is the 15th, and in Jerusalem the 14th, it doesn't look good. But you see already the rabbis are concerned because Israel was sort of like people weren't there. And the Jews who were there probably resented. That's what the Jews in Shushan, they're having a nice life. They're partying. They're good. And so there's just like there is today tension between the Jews of the diaspora and the Jews in Israel. We all know that. Tensions come into the in the open a lot recently, but obviously, because the concerns for people who live in Israel are different. They, you know, Israelis don't care about a lot of the things we care about, and they're not worried about intermarriage, and they're not worried about the cost of day school education. It doesn't concern them, you know. So we have a different way of thinking. So, anyways, that's just some background. Okay, let's get back to what I wanted to talk about. Okay, but no, I like questions. That's great. Okay, so what did we say so far? Purim shouldn't be a holiday because there's no God. It's out of Israel. People are assimilated. We're paying taxes. Nothing happened. So, of course, then we have to answer, so why is it? So I've already alluded to that, it's the story of Purim really in one nutshell. If you, the one sentence, the key of this class, whatever, is that Purim is how to live as Jews when God is not directing us, when there's no prophecy anymore. And we said that's sort of a good thing because you have to grow up. At a certain point, kids, and so when the kid leaves the house, you're a little sad that when your 21-year-old kid gets married, you know, but when your 35-year-old kid is like, that's already different, you know, like, you want to throw him out of the house already. And, so the Jewish people had to learn how to live. And then question, of course, so how do we do that? And, the notion of that you want to call her an assimilated Jew who intermarried, who married a Chashveirosh, and, you know, that's also actually an important message for us because, often the great, you know, great leaders of the Jewish people are not people who necessarily have deep roots in Judaism. Take Herzl. I remember when I was in high school, so my Rosh Yeshiva, Ever Refuah Shleim, is very not well, Rav Tabori. So I went Orchheim right here across the street where I went to high school. So, he told us we like people in the modern Orthodox world, whatever you want to call it, religious Zionist world, we have an issue with Herzl. If you're a secular Zionist, Herzl's the greatest hero in 2000 years. If you're, they wouldn't have the term back then, but if you're like a Haredi Jew, Herzl is a Apikoris, you know, a heretic. He was happy to have Israel in Uganda. He was totally religious. Nothing. We see both sides. We don't want a state like Herzl where the prostitutes will be like, it was Herzl or Ben Gurion that said, we know Israel, when Israel becomes a normal country and they're prostitutes and see, that's not the country we want. We don't want to be like everybody else. No, we don't want to be. We're different. We do have a double standard, but Herzl was great. He was also great. So you live with that tension. But it's often the assimilated Jew who makes the great movement, and that was for sure true with the founding of the State of Israel. Most religious Jews rejected. We're not in favor of Zionism because they wait for the Mashiach to come. What right do we have to hasten the days? That was a very common argument until Hitler, Yimach Shemo. That changed the way people thought about the need for a state of Israel. And the fact that Israel and outside, it's also an important message. We might be different, but we share the same fate. Today, 7 people broke away from in England in the Labour Party, right, to start their own party. Because England might get an anti-Semitic prime minister. Like, it's not so good. And that's the world never changes. So it's Rav Soloveitchik develops that point that Purim is the message that the Jew's fate outside of Israel is always a precarious fate. And that's why the Megillah ends with us paying taxes. We can still celebrate. We had a victory. Things were good. And it's not bad to pay taxes if that's all you're doing. But the Megillah doesn't end on a like, wow, something happened. The Megillah ends, you know. You never know. We say for this Haman, but the next Haman may not be so good. So the fate of the Jew is always precarious, and Jews are always interwoven, and that's the message Purim. Because what does a poor mean?
A lottery.
Life is a little bit, you know, chance, lottery. You never know. And of course, okay, maybe I'll just say it now already. Once we're on the topic, what other holiday? What name? What does Purim remind you of? Yom Kippur, Yom Kippurim. The sages point out Yom Kippurim. Yom Kippur is a day like Purim, which means what's a greater day? If Yom Kippur is like Purim, Kippurim, Yom Kippur is Yom Kippur. So Purim is greater. Yom Kippur is like Purim. It's like, yes, that's like, are they out of their minds? Are the rabbis like, what were they drinking when they said this? Because
it was during Purim.
That's the point. You cannot think of the two most opposite days of the Jewish calendar than Yom Kippur and Purim. That's exactly the point. Rav Soloveitchik, that life is, he said that repentance, so much of life is based on fate. Yom Kippur too. We say, God, we sinned. Well, you know, you live in 21st century America. I got sinned. If I lived in the shtetl in Poland in the beginning of 20th century, I'd be a nice pious Jew. But what do you expect from me in America? Like, you know, I mean, that's just one example. But Yom Kippur, and we can service God through fasting and feasting or through, either through fasting or feasting, right? You can serve God. And what the rabbi is saying is to service God through feasting is better. That's better. That's a higher level, right? And you look, what do we do on Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur, we eat. There's a mitzvah to eat, even if you're not going to fast. If you're not well and can't fast, you have to eat on the ninth. And then you have to fast. On Tanit Esther, we fast and then we eat. It's sort of the reverse. They're both 2 days because, as Rabbi Soloveitchik explains, both days celebrate and the good and are nervous about the future. So what happened on Yom Kippur? God reestablished the covenant that was broken with the breaking of the golden calf this week. We're going to read in Shul this week, the story of the golden calf. So that, the real Torah that we have, that's another reason Shavuos doesn't celebrate the giving of the Torah. Because we didn't, the Torah we got on Shavuos, we broke that Torah. We don't want to celebrate that. We celebrate Torah on Yom Kippur. That's what the rabbis say. We got the Torah again on Yom Kippur. It's supposed to be a very happy day. It is a very happy day. But it's also, we have to repent. So these two moods are in conflict. So the ninth of Tishrei becomes the day where we celebrate. We eat, we've got the Torah. And the tenth becomes, you know, the day of nervousness. And Purim is the same thing. We celebrate the victory 14th, but the nervousness, we celebrate, we observe on the 13th, Tanit Esther. We start, you know, with the fast of Esther, which, by the way, happened when? Historically, in the Megillah, when? Tanit Esther didn't happen on the 13th of Adar. Like the story happened on Pesach. If you look in the Megillah, it's the 13th of Nisan, right? They're cleaning up for all the Chametz. I don't know exactly what they were doing, but in Persia they got the candle, the broom. They were doing Bedichas Chametz, and then Haman said, "I'm going to kill the Jews on the 13th of Adar." And Mordechai goes out into the street, and all of a sudden they have a 3-day fast day. And the rabbis say there was a fast day. It's Pesach. So Esther said, "Pesach, you're worried about Pesach. If we don't fast and get this, you know, get God on our side, we're not going to have a Jewish people. There won't be any Pesach." So we're canceling Pesach this year. All the women were happy, but I don't know. I should. God forbid. That's a terrible thing to say. People clean too much for anyway. Okay, forget that. Okay, anyways, that's so that's when they fasted. But we then took that fast and we put it the day before Purim. Okay, all right. Let's discuss a little bit in the few minutes we have left. There's a lot to discuss. I hope you'll come back. We'll discuss more, but let's discuss some of the antecedents of the Megillah. I said the Megillah lacks historical context. Okay. So what books of the Bible, you have to realize the first commentary on the Bible is the Bible. No. The later books comment on the, or as Rabbi Soloveitchik said, the stories in the Bible, the laws in the, or it works both ways. Sometimes the laws are comments on the stories, or the stories are comments on the law. Like, I'll give you an interesting example. Maybe you didn't think of it because we'll, Yosef, right? What did the brothers do to Yosef? What did they do? How did they trick their father?
They dipped it in
a goat, and they said their father dipped the blood. What do we have to do every Yontif? According to the Torah, what's one of the laws of Yontif? You have to bring a goat as an offering. Why don't we bring a goat? A sin offering on Yontif. On all the Yom Tov, we bring what we call peace offerings, like or Olah, really. They bring, the Jews bring a peace offering, means you eat it. Then you bring a Korban Olah, means you dedicate it to God. Then we have a weird thing. Every single holiday, every biblical holiday, has a Seir Chi Izi Mechatat, a goat for a sin offering. Why? Because to remind us, what are the holidays all celebrate? Egypt. Zecher Litzia Mitzrayim. Well, why do we go to Egypt? Because the brothers, they sold Yosef. It's all started with that. So the Torah is bringing this law, bringing a goat, because to remind ourselves of the goat that the brothers dipped the blood in. Let's take this week's Parsha, the Chet Egel. So what law in the Torah do you have as with the Chet Egel? This is a tougher one, but which story do you have? Which story in the Bible, which law in the Bible involves an eagle, a calf, a young calf?
The red heifer.
The red heifer is a big calf, a big cow. So correct. I wasn't thinking of that, but 100% right. The para, that's what the rabbis say. The para comes to clean up. The mother cleans up the sins of the baby. That's how the Medrash, I think, points. The para, I wasn't thinking of that, so I'm going to leave that for a site. I'll look more into it, but for sure, Rabbi Soloveitchik knows a whole piece on that. The para aduma, the red heifer, as an atonement for the egel hazah. But I was thinking of an egel itself.
For Isaac, the one that was caught in the thickets that they sacrificed.
So that's an ayil. That was a ram, which we also bring on Yom Tovim, but there is later on in Sefer Dvarim, it's an Egla Rufa. What's an Egla Rufa? If you find a dead body and you don't know who killed the person. So the rabbis of the nearest town have to bring an Egel, a calf, and have to slaughter it from the back of the neck and say, we didn't kill this person. So the Talmud says, what do you mean? Who in their right mind thinks the rabbi killed the people? What the rabbis in the court, they're murderers? I mean, some of the rabbis sin, but they don't murder. They weren't murderers. How many, you know? So, oh my God. So the rabbi said, no, it doesn't mean murder. It means we didn't escort him. They have to bring us in case they didn't escort him and give him food. A stranger, why somebody killed out on the street? Because they're, The lights aren't good, the police protection isn't good, nobody escorted him. That's the fault of the rabbis. When something happens in the city, the leaders have to take the blame. It's nobody thinks they killed him, but they passively killed him. So the Egla Arufa is the sin on passivity. How many Jews sinned in the golden calf? How many Jews worship the golden calf? It's in this Parsha. I know it's been 51 weeks since we read it, so you have a good excuse. In 51 weeks. Next week, you don't have a good excuse, but this week, you have a good excuse. How many people worship the golden calf, it says in the Torah? 3,000. How many Jews were there? Let's say men between 20 and 60, 600,000. 600,000 men. The 3,000, and that's point. I'm not even counting all the women. The rabbis say the women didn't worship the golden calf, but okay. The women were on a much higher level, which is true. They were. So 99.5% of the men did not worship the golden calf. That's a pretty great ratio. God got angry, wants to destroy the people because 0.05% of the people worship the golden calf. What's going on here? So what's the sin of the golden calf? How could it be? How could 600,000 people let 3,000 people sin? What did they do? Why did they do it? They were passive. I'm not going to give up. I'm not my business. So the atonement is the Egla Rufa. That when there's a dead body, you have to bring an ego. Because the sin of the golden calf is not, how many Jews worship idols? We worship money. Okay, that's a bigger idol. But no, I mean that in all seriousness. I don't mean that as a joke. We all worship idols. What you think, when the Torah talks about a avodah zarah, obviously we all have idols. But, okay, it's not technically maybe idol worship. But, how many Jews, worship idols, but how many Jews are passive and don't get involved with this? That's the real sin. The golden calf, who cares? It's not for us. But we're passive when other people do wrong, of course. So later on in the Torah, we have a law. But that, so that's all the time. So the Bible, within the Bible itself, the Bible's commenting on itself. For sure, Kalvachomer ben Beno, whatever, how you say that in English, you can't say that in English. Of course, later books in the Bible comment on earlier books in the Bible. They play off the authors of the later, and the Megillah and Esther is probably the last book written in the Bible. Probably the last book, except, so it's, hold on, let me figure it out. I don't know, it's about 1500 years after the Torah. It's a long time. It's a long time. That's a lot to work with. The first temple was built 480 years after they left Egypt, and it stood for 410 years. So we're already up to 890 years, whatever. And then, so it's maybe a little less, it's less than 1500 years. And then 100 years later, so we're talking 1,000 years, right? So, So what books is Esther, what stories is Esther Carmen? So well, there's a famous one we'll have to pick up next week, but let's just do a little bit here. We'll start with let's do a little of the Megillah. How does the Megillah start? Vayehi, Mimei Achashverosh, it's such a beautiful tune. Hu Achashverosh, right? That phrase is also very strange. It was in the days of Achashverosh, it's just like, Achashverosh, I never heard of Achashverosh, right? Because that's the whole point of the Megillah. Who is this Achashverosh? He is the king from Hodu at Kush, 127 like countries. So you know, Achashverosh, this is the only time in the Megillah that there's something missing when we mention Achashverosh. Who's Achashverosh always? How's Achashverosh always referred to? Hamelach Achashverosh. Hamelach, I believe it's 203 times. Now you know why God's name isn't mentioned in the Megillah? Because Achashverosh thought he was God. We'll develop that theme. Achashverosh is a God. The Talmud says when a person is arrogant, God can't dwell in this. There isn't room for God. You have to be humble. What's the trait of Moshe Rabbeinu? Humble. The one thing we know about Moshe. One thing Torah says, Moshe Ya'anaf, Mikol Adam Al-Pnei Adamai. He was the most humble of all people. When you meet greatness, when you really meet God, you become humble. You know, when you think you're big knucker, so you're arrogant. So Achashverosh is like the most arrogant king. And as we'll maybe pick up, how does he build his cat? You know, it's Chor, Karpasut, Chelet, Borgam. It's all the things of the Mishkan. Chatzer HaPnimit. Nobody can come in, like the Holy of Holies in the temple. Nobody can come in. And if you go in, you can die. If the king doesn't let you in, Achashverosh is God. His court is the temple. The Megillah is clearly playing off of this. The Megillah is, even I saw this cute, and I never, you know, in W. Silver's book, Chor, Karpasut, Chelet. It's just a cute little thing. Who's Chor? Chor in the Megillah is one of the materials in the thing. But Chor was the grandfather of Bezalel, who built the Mishkan, Bezalel ben Uri ben Chor. All these Tchelet, they're all playing off the Mishkan, because Achashverosh is this king. He's God. So there's no room for God in the Megillah. I mean, besides, you know, when we were talking about, you know, God, because there are messages for the Jew without God, that's sort of the rabbinic, that's understanding the message for us. We also have to understand the Megillah on its own level. Just, you know, just read the Megillah. Yeah. So there's no room for God. Now, let's start first verse. King Achashverosh is the king of 127 people, 127 countries. You believe that? See, so numbers in the Bible for sure aren't true. That's for sure. I mean, they're not. Like, the numbers in the Bible are ideas. So they're always rounded off. Numbers for sure. I'll give you the best example. You know the count of the Jews in Israel? We started at 837, right? So I can go to 937?
Oh, yeah.
No, I don't want to go more than an hour. But you know when they count the Jews ready to go to Israel in the book of Amir, 603,550, right? So that's if you look in Bamidbar, every single tribe ends with 100. Or 200, 400, 700, 800. There are 12 tribes. Everyone except one ends with a 50. I think it's Reuven. It's every single one. But now the odds of that happening are like 1 in 85 trillion. Like mathematically speaking, to take 12 numbers, thousands of now they count them again 40 years later, and it's 601,730. And again, every single tribe ends with 100. Now the odds of that having choice there are like 80 gazillion trillion. I can't even mention the odds. No, with one tribe, had 30. Even the 50 and the 30 are probably rounded off. 50 and 30, you know, that was God. Reuven and God are the two tribes. I forget which is which. One is, now, what's the Torah? You don't have to know anything. When do you know about Reuven and God?
Well, they didn't want to go into Israel.
These two counts are going to Israel. Everybody else has a number of the hundreds, except for Reuven and God. Tell me that's the Bible is telling us exact numbers. Bible is telling us the whole idea. You just look at numbers. We discuss it all the time on Sukkot, the sacrifice. I won't go into that one now. I'll do one more. How old was Moshe when he went to Egypt? This is just the simple. How old was Moshe when he came to Paro?
80.
80. It says he was 80. How old was he when he died?
120.
How long were they in the desert?
40 years.
How long does that leave for the whole story of the Esther Makot? There's no time. Now, the rabbis say it took well over a year, at least a year. They're rounded off. Numbers are always ideas in the Bible. Whenever you see a number, because In other words, why does the Torah tell us how old this person was they died, but not that person? In other words, why is Avram 175 and Yitzchak's 180? And Yaakov's 147? The rabbi, that's not coincidence. And why are Yishmael, now I forget, the three people who lived to be 137 years old? They're collected. So what does 127 remind you of? Clearly. Maybe not so clearly. Okay. The number 127 in the Bible, where does that appear?
How old was Sarah when she died?
127.
Yeah.
Vahi mechaya mea shana, srim shana, sheva shanim. She was 127. Now, the Medrash quotes Rabbi Akiva, the kids were sleeping in the shir, he's giving us the class, and he wanted to wake them up. So he said, you know why Esther was the queen over 127? Because Sarah lived to be 127. What kind of narishkeit is that? Right? So what's the Megillah doing? The Megillah is linking, is telling us the story of Esther and Sarah are connected. What's the connection between Sarah? Let's just take it on the simple level. What's the link between Sarah and Esther?
Sarah also had an episode when she was younger where she had to disguise her true identity before the...
And she was excellent. She was taken by the king against her will. This is exactly the story of Purim. Esther and Sarah are taken in by the foreign king. Live with, you know, which is exactly what goes on. It's cute. W. Savrapa points out the last thing when Mordechai, and when they send out the letter, you know, that all the men should be the rulers of the house, right? That's the letter they have here. So it's probably, that's an Achashverosh idea. So he said, Liokolish Sorer Bebeto. It's the same root as Sarah. But that's, anyways, you have a lot of it. What we'll have to pick up on is the story of Yosef. If you want to think about it, if you like it and you want to come back next week, I hope so, then we'll talk about the story of Yosef. There are like 9,500 parallels between the Yosef story and the story of the Megillah. And it's clear that the author of the Megillah was working with the Yosef story in the language. The language is the same, and also the work. But there you go. So basically, we tried to say today why Purim shouldn't be a holiday, all the problems in Purim. I have to start with all the problems. We try to solve them a little bit. Purim, whether it happened historically or not, is not the point. As I do believe it happened. But it doesn't really matter. The point is not because the point, especially by Purim, is not to be historical. It's, I don't know who Achashverosh is. I mean, we try to identify him. It's the story of the Jew in exile. It's the story of the Jew without God. It's the story of Jew standing, we don't know what to do. And we'll see there's a lot of tension between Mordechai and Esther. Obviously, they're fighting a lot, all kinds of things. So, I'll take any quick questions then. I guess people are supposed to eat something, right?
Please, everyone, take cake. If you don't eat cake, then I will eat it and Lori won't be very happy at all.
Thank you very much. Okay. Lila Tov.
Thank you.
Thank you.